Hello, and welcome to this rather unusual episode of Golden Grenades. Regular listeners will know that this podcast is named after the clenched fists of my favourite bird, the fastest animal on the planet, the mighty peregrine falcon. My love and fascination with these aerial masters goes way back to when I was in junior school, and we were shown a BBC educational programme once a week on the telly called Look and Read. The aim of the programme was to improve our reading and writing, and it included a serialised drama segment, and the particular storyline that made a 9-year-old me sit up on the parquet school floor and stare at the big telly on wheels with rapt attention was called Sky Hunter. Sky Hunter was a story about three children on a canal boat holiday in London stumbling on a plot to sell a stolen peregrine falcon and a collection of falcon eggs. Jackie, Trevor and Butch have befriended a kindly old antiques dealer, Mr. Trim, who was revealed later as a baddie in cahoots with two bumbling crooks, Cat Mary and Badger. There's an RSPB investigator, some quality slapstick, and some genuinely creepy and scary moments. It was brilliant and formative for me, and hooked me on birds for life, especially the peregrine falcon. And it played no small part in the lifetime of enjoyment I've had from birds. A few years ago, I narrated a tweet of the day for BBC Radio 4 on the peregrine falcon, and naturally, Sky Hunter got a mention. And somehow, that tweet of the day was heard by the producer of the programme, Roger Tong, who dropped me a line and inspired me to make a special podcast episode based on the show. I wanted to find out about the inspiration behind the storyline from those who created it, to see if anyone else has such fond memories of it as me, and to learn more about bird crimes then and now. There's no better place to start than with the man I've just mentioned, the producer and director on the programme, Roger Tong. Roger, hi!
Hello, Kit.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I think the best place to start would just be if you could tell me where the idea for Sky Hunter came from in the first place.
Well, it was my first drama. I'd been doing documentaries up to that time. And so now they gave me a chance to do a drama. And it wasn't for my normal teenage audience. It was for primary schools. I'd been, first of all, I'd had a canal boat holiday that summer. And as an RSPB member, I'd been reading a lot about, at that time, quite a few criminal goings-on in terms of egg stealing and this market in Raptor, selling them abroad. And I'd seen one or two articles about sort of the latest case under the name of, well, Peter Robinson, this detective. I'd never heard that the RSPB had detectives, you know. To me, it was a load of old twitchers and people like that, like me. So here was a detective. This was very exciting. So it was my suggestion that we do something on that, because obviously for kids, this is going to be very, very interesting. My series producer, the executive producer, really liked the idea. And away we went. A bit more contact with Peter Robinson. I hope he remembers. And a bit of background like that. And we used Leonard Kingston, who had some experience in writing for Look and Read on other sort of whodunits. And he took to the idea very much, simply with the remit, set it on the canal. There is a bird. Yeah, you know, they see a bird. And there are bad people and there are good people. Go ahead and write it. But I do remember having long walks with him along the canal. And he's a wonderfully crazy, funny, enthusiastic guy, a bit zany and eccentric too. And it was just up his street.
Oh, that's brilliant. I did, when I first had this idea, I did find his daughter, because Leonard Kingston sadly passed away in 2014. But I found his daughter online and I had a lovely chat with her. I'm just asking about him and what he was like as a person. He was an actor, a teacher and a writer as well, obviously. And he may not have been a keen ornithologist, but he was, I understand, he was very keen on the outdoors generally. And he was an early adopter of cycling as a mode of transport.
Yeah, I remember that.
His green credentials were high, yeah.
We cycled along the canal together.
Brilliant.
Part of the research, yes.
And Peter Robinson, for many years, he was the head of the crime investigations unit at the RSPB. And I don't think he works. He doesn't. Well, he doesn't work for the RSPB now, but he's still very active in the bird field. What do you remember, Roger, about the shoot generally?
Well, it was my first time with actors, and that was exciting and daunting at the same time. Mr. Trim, Geoffrey Belden, was introduced to me by somebody who'd already worked with him, and he liked the idea very much. So it became less daunting and more fun as the time went on. But basically also because the script was so good. I mean, here was a script that just to read it made me chuckle. And you can't do a film without a good script. You can mess up a good script, but you can't make a good film when the script is no good. Yeah, it was just something wonderful to get my hands on. But I think the best thing was getting to know the actors and the joy of working with them. The three youngsters were eager. Each of them had had some experience before. But the adults, I mean, to work with Geoffrey Belden was terrific.
And Geoffrey Belden was maybe known to people from his Catweasel days.
Catweasel days, yes. And then Mike and Isabel playing Cat Mary and Badger.
Yeah, they were a horrible trio, really. And, you know, as a child watching it, they were quite scary. And we've got Jane Rose, who played Jackie, joining us in a moment. And I'm sure she'll have something to say about that.
Mr. Trim was one of my favourite characters. I mean, the way he was double dealing is just kind of it's a joy. I'm sure Jane will remember the scene where Trim has pretended to be on the side of the kids, and they go to the house where Badger and Cat Mary are hiding, and Trim is saying, right, we will go and get them, something like that. But you stay here, kids. And the kids see him from 20 yards away, knocks at the door, and whoosh, Badger seems to recognize him. That's interesting. And then Trim is saying, keep your mouth shut, Badger. Pretend you don't know me. Then he goes in, the door opens. It's all right, children, you can come in now. That sort of duplicity playing, from which, of course, we get the can you trust Mr. Trim? Notice the play on TR.
Yep.
And this is where Leonard Kingston was so good, because you actually have to write in a certain controlled way. Remember, it's a learning to read program. The whole script is analyzed by computer and certain sequences are picked out. So, for instance, that particular episode had a lot of words TR. And I think you'd find in that episode there's three or four more TRs. So you get a sort of song on TNR.
Yeah.
Now, Leonard Kingston took all that on board and was prepared to change words, put in a different word, change character names, simply to fit that sort of model. Now, not many writers would do that.
And the other thing that he had to do as well was, this was serialized across a number of shows. And it was just part...
Cliffhangers.
Yeah, there was a cliffhanger every like
it's
9 or 10 minutes.
Unbelievable. Because there are two sections in each, in 8 minutes, and then you've got the middle teaching bit, and then 8 minutes more. So each 8-minute section had to have cliffhangers. Now, if you reckon the whole film is about 100 minutes long, just the film on its own, there must be cliffhangers every 8 minutes. And I often think we should string the film together. How would it look? And I think one thing which might spoil it, you'd suddenly be aware of these cliffhanger, da 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 da, cliffhanger, da 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 da, cliffhanger. It'd be great fun to put the film elements all together.
It is all together, Roger, on the internet. I've watched it all recently, so I will send it to you and you can watch it back. And it's brilliant. It doesn't seem forced or unnatural at all. It just seems really exciting.
So right.
It's great.
So the kids rescued, and right at the end, of course, and this is always a sort of lovely emotional thing in a film where with all animal films, you make friends with the animal and so forth, but the animal must be restored to nature. But that was a sort of, in a gentle way, a lovely emotional sequence where the bird has to be returned to nature. So we go to an expert person who does this sort of thing for birds and obviously a real lover of birds. And he lives over in Wolverhampton, I think it was. Jane will remind me. Anyway, somewhere in the Midlands, we had to go for, I think, for 2 days.
this would be an opportune moment for us to bring in Jane. Jane Rose, previously Topman, who played Jackie, one of the three main children characters on the programme. Hi, Jane.
Hello, Kit.
Hi, Roger.
Hello, Jane. How many years is it? 40 years.
40 years. And I think the last time we saw each other was about 30 years ago. So a long time.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Welcome.
You played Jackie, the plucky, brave and resourceful one of the three children in the show. And as a nine-year-old watching Sky Hunter, it looked like messing about on boats and throwing bumbling bad guys into canals and being an amateur detective must have been the best fun ever. What do you remember from that time?
Oh, gosh. Well, it was really, really amazing time. I remember doing the audition, first of all, because I was at a stage school. In fact, all three of us, or three children, were at different stage schools in London. So I remember meeting Roger, very first audition. He came to my school and then going to the BBC and doing a second audition and then hearing that I got the part. And after reading so many kind of Famous Five novels, it was just great to be part of that kind of programme where the children were involved in a mystery. And we started filming, I think it was about 1978 when we started filming it. So a long, long time ago. And I watched it again recently. Thank you for sending me the link. It was really lovely. It was great fun. And my favourite bit was being on the barge. I loved being on that barge and being by the river. I think probably it took about 8 weeks or so to film. It was quite a long time that we were together. So it was great. I just really, really had a blast doing it.
Roger mentioned earlier, Jane, some of the scenes, particularly with the bad guys, Cat Mary and Badger, and the kindly antique shopkeeper, Mr. Trim, who turns out to be quite evil, but then has a redemptive part to the story at the end.
Yeah.
Seeing his collection of eggs upstairs when the kids go in is really one of the shock moments.
Oh, do you know, that was the one scene that I will always remember, us creeping up the stairs and then discovering that room with, and it was the one day that I really didn't enjoy filming. I just found that whole room really eerie and made me feel uncomfortable. And just there was the stuffed birds everywhere and the drawers full of eggs.
It was gruesome.
Oh, it was. And even though it was a set, it just felt wrong. It was just horrid, I remember.
But also Roger Lim, the music writer, the composer.
Yes. When we go up the stairs, yes.
Up the stairs and then suddenly opening, all decibels went crazy at that moment.
Yeah.
It's really quite an exciting moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, it was. Horrid.
I think the viewer is the children watching feel that as well. And when you see it on your face and the other children characters' faces, I'm guessing the boys felt creeped out as well because it is menacing and creepy. I'm sure you weren't alone in feeling that that was... Well, fairly unpleasant, and it was meant to be unpleasant.
Yes.
Kit, you speak as a child. You speak as one of our viewers.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the horror of it all. And just the I think almost as horrible as that scene is just the creepiness of the adult characters as well as a child.
And I actually really was so frightened, generally frightened by Cat Mary. I remember I didn't hardly speak to Isabel, the actress that played her, because I found her very frightening. And I was trying to think, why did I used to find her frightening? And I think it was because the tone of her voice was like an old teacher that I had at junior school. And the way she used to shout at you and... little girl, she used to say, that teacher used to talk to us like that. But I'm sure Isabel must have thought I was very aloof because I never went near her. I used to chat to Mike that played Badger. He was very funny, wasn't he? He was very funny in real life. So he would always joke with us children. But Cat Mary. Goodness.
Well, that's good.
She did a great job. She was fantastic.
And of course, she acted as a very strong woman in 1978. We wanted women like that, but preferably not involved in crookery.
No.
Your character, Jackie, was definitely the best of the three. Because
you... A bit bossy, though, wasn't she?
Well, you know, she was the first one to spot the peregrine and point out how cool it was. You know, she's got that moment where they're all going, it's a duck, it's a parakeet. Yes. And you say something like, whatever it is, it's great. It's it's beautiful. And so you're the first one to recognize that it's awesome. And then towards the end, after you've been kidnapped and left by the boys, by the way, and you get rescued, then you have that speech against Mr. Trim, who was a terrifying character, because he's such a likable, kindly old man who's befriending the children, and then all of a sudden he's a baddie. And I mean, as a 9-year-old watching that, it was kind of like, oh my goodness, grown-ups who are nice can turn out to be nasty. You know, it was
It was
properly well written. But yeah, that speech that you have when you were like, criticizing him and taking him down for being an egg collector, and you know, you just want the money, you don't want to protect birds, you only like it when they're dead and stuffed and standing about in your rotten collection, you're just selfish and greedy. I love that.
You did it so well then.
I didn't go to stage school or anything.
Then she goes on to trust him again, and as I said, I was watching it quite recently and I was thinking, no, why are you trusting him again?
This is another strong point, I think, in the drama, that he is redeemed in the end.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you go into Whipsnade Zoo and he is on the side of the kids.
Yeah.
Really, this Trim, can you trust him? On whose side? Now he's back on the kids' side.
Pretending he's still a bad guy. So, yeah, he's tricking the bad guys. So good.
And I don't know if you remember, Roger, but the boys used to joke with me whenever we were kind of finishing for the day filming, they always used to say, will we see you again? You know my line where I used to say that to my friends. And they even did it when we were doing Sky Hunter 2 when we were in our 20s. Will we see you again? That was a sweet thing that they used to do.
And what a great story it is, though, still. To this day, I'm delighted, having watched it again recently, that it's not lost none of its charm and none of the fond memories I have of it. I didn't watch it back and think, oh, that's really dated or that's not as good as I remember. It's just brilliant. And I think it is testament to the story and the actors' performances.
You pick a sequence that really makes you sort of grin. And
well, I mean, as a kid, you know, it's Badger ends up in the drink about three times. It's fantastic. Watching it back, you know, just the chase scenes, you know, really exciting. The creepiness, it's just got everything. It's late 70s, perfect kids telly. I'm saying that about late 70s, but it obviously was repeated through the 80s. It even got a new lease of life as Sky Hunter 2 in the early 90s, 1992, I think, where Jackie and Trevor and Butch now work for the RSPB. And Auntie Sharon has married the Birdman. And, you know, it brings it all full circle. And it was repeated even through the 90s and the mid-noughties. It was on CBBC for a good few years, repeated.
Gosh. Oh, and I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I think that you know, it stood the test of time and it's been shown through all those decades over and over again. I don't know, I guess you probably didn't if you were at stage school, but I mean, this was a major source of excitement when you were normal junior school and they wheeled the big telly into the hall and you all trooped out of class and sat down in front of Look and Read.
Oh.
And, you know, and then you got 9 minutes of Sky Hunter and you had to wait till next week to find out what happened. It was brilliant.
It was good, actually. It's funny because a few programs on the telly now are making you wait, aren't they, again? You can't just stream. And actually, I think it's better. I think it's better to be able to think about it over that week and then look forward to the next episode. But one of my sons came out of school and he said, oh, Mum, we've been watching you on the TV. We were watching Sky Hunter. And I was saying to my friends, that's my mother. And they weren't believing me, but they did after they all came out and they were like glaring at me, and then they realized that it was me when I was younger. So I was famous in his school for about 10 minutes. That was pretty sweet.
Well, that's strange, because my kids both were shown it.
Oh,
in
really?
Yeah, so they must have, I think their teacher must have seen it as a child and maybe shown it to them.
Oh, that's lovely.
So it's still doing the rounds.
Incredible that that show made you become an ornithologist. I mean, that's just incredible.
I must have had a little bit of an interest. But then, then, you know, it just really took off after that, and particularly peregrine falcons. That became my favourite bird, and I was desperate to see one. And, you know, I now do a podcast based on peregrine falcons, loosely based on peregrine falcons, but chatting about birds. So it's it has brought me a lifetime of enjoyment by loving birds, you know, and the pleasure I get from birds is potentially all down to Skyhunter. So, you know, it's fantastic.
Oh, cheers.
And other people who I'm going to be speaking to later on the podcast have even gone one or two steps further than that, you know, and made careers out of it. So, yeah, it's been a brilliant thing. Wasn't there something, Roger, about an unexpected plant in one of the scenes?
This is along the canal, like most locations were along the canal. They went into this house, and it was a commune. It was a whole street, and they actually live opposite. I lived in that area, Hackney, Victoria Park, and when we were watching the rushes, somebody must have said, "Hey, do you know that plant behind Mr. Trim?" As he's frightening the kids. No, no, as he's being sweet to the kids, pretending to the kids. "Do you know that plant? That is cannabis." Now, this must have come out there, because Jane, you remember, we went back to refilm.
Oh, yeah. Because if you'd picked a cannabis farm as a location.
Yeah. Out went all those plants, and probably a few aspidistras or something like that went.
Do you know, I have watched it back recently, and there definitely isn't any plants on the windowsill, unless I've missed it, but I don't think there is.
Oh, I'm a bit disappointed at that.
Oh, sorry.
There's another secret, however. We were talking about the bird going back into nature in Northampton, was it? And this chap, he was the owner of the bird, and it was a sort of like a small holding, as I remember. Anyway, the filming was over, and we'd gone on very well with him and so on. And Roger, you want to come and see this? Come with me, I'll show you something. And he opened a few doors into a barn, and there he said, "Look," and there was some small peregrine falcons.
No.
Yeah, babies. And he said, they've just come in, about four or five of them.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Did you get straight on the phone to Peter Robinson?
No, I didn't know if that man had heavies behind him or something. No, I was very affable and so gormlessly said, "Oh, really?" But it was a crisis. And it was only about 3 months later that I told the RSPB. I certainly didn't go straight away.
I guess you had a job to do and you were nervous about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I just felt I couldn't have a confrontation with this crook. And there was still some filming to be done, I think, that afternoon or something like that. But it was a big shock.
That's unbelievable, considering the main theme of the story.
Well, yeah, absolutely contrary to it.
Unbelievable. So the bird is being rehabilitated to be released back into the wild. And it is a bittersweet moment as a kid, because for weeks you've watched this show. You've got to love it. You've got to love the characters. It's all the peril and the excitement. And then it's the end and the bird is being released to the wild. It's a beautiful thing.
It was quite sad, actually. But it was so exciting when we went up to Northampton to see it learning to be out in the wild again. And I remember the chap put the big glove on our arms so that it allowed the bird to come and stand on our arms. And I remember feeling it was so heavy. I don't know how heavy he is, a peregrine falcon, but at the time I only had little arms. So
yeah, it would definitely be weightier. The glove itself would have been quite heavy.
But Yeah, it was wonderful. I think it was like having a little holiday at the end of the filming, wasn't it, Roger? It was
Oh,
great.
yes.
It was like just us all going away to celebrate the end of the filming and then seeing the beautiful bird.
And you got to be a little amateur falconer for a short time as well. I can't not mention to you about your other work, though. And even if anybody's listening to this podcast and they haven't seen Sky Hunter, you may well have seen Jane in a terrifying infomercial that did the rounds in the late 70s and early 80s about the dangers of throwing a frisbee into a pylon and then climbing it to retrieve the frisbee. And it's just that blood-curdling scream of yours when you scream, "Jimmy!" And then poor Jimmy ends up on fire. That is harrowing.
I know, it's funny how many people still talk about that. And as I said, my children, I'd forgotten about it, but my nephew found it, I think on YouTube, and was showing it to my two sons over Christmas, and they were horrified by it as well.
It's
Incredible.
grim. I'm sure we must have been shown that in school, but I think it was around about the time when, the Green Cross Code man and Rolf Harris of all people telling you to learn to swim. We'll not dwell on that. I guess parents weren't supposed to give that sort of information to anybody back then. You relied on scary videos for kids
Oh,
to
God.
be shown in school. And your foray into working with animals didn't just end with peregrines, did it? You had a turn with a cat in a very, very famous film.
In Superman 1. Yes. And do you know that little clip took about 5 nights to film? Because it was kept on snowing. It was in February. It kept on snowing and it was very slippy and cold and misty and foggy. And so they had to keep on just doing a little bit and then just saying, "We've got to come back again tomorrow." So the cat kept on jumping out of my arm. So I know there's a bit where I'm holding it, and poor little thing, I was really holding it very tightly. That's the only two times, actually, with animals.
You should have asked her. Well, it wouldn't have worked in the film, I guess, because Superman had to get the cat from the tree, but Jackie would have just gone up the tree and got it.
She wouldn't have bothered with Superman.
She wouldn't have
In
needed
her
him.
dungarees, yet she would have been able to climb that tree really well.
She
That's
definitely
true.
would have solved the problem
Oh.
herself. So, Roger, Jane, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing those memories with me.
Thank you. It's been lovely to speak to you, Kit, and thank you so much for finding me.
Having spoken to Roger and Jane about their recollections of creating Sky Hunter, I was keen to delve more into the murky waters of bird crimes in the 1970s. So, who better to contact than Peter Robinson, the man Roger Tong himself cited as the main inspiration for the story? Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. You were the head of criminal investigations at the RSPB at the time that Sky Hunter was written and worked there for 16 years. I wondered if you could give me an idea of what bird crimes were taking place at that time.
Okay, I mean, it was very much then the same as now. Some of the offences that were a problem back then have eased off a bit. Probably egg collecting. The number of people being prosecuted is fewer. But then again, I had this worry that we don't always hear from the RSPB what is actually going on. And the other thing that's changed dramatically is that people of my age back then, I was 40 something, 40, 50 years old. Therefore, when I first came into the world, it was commonplace for people to collect eggs, and it wasn't an offence then to collect birds' eggs. And it was only when you got into the 1940s, 50s that particularly the RSPB started putting pressure upon egg collectors to cease their activities. And by the time the 1981 Act was implemented, they could no longer use the legislation to cover eggs that they had. The big point about the 1981 Act was that the goalpost shifted from me having to prove that you're guilty So you having to prove to me that you're innocent, that was a huge measure.
And in the programme Sky Hunter, the children in the show discover that a peregrine has been taken from the wild and, you know, being sold illegally, and also there is illegal sale of eggs going on as well. You know, I'm guessing that in your time you had to investigate a lot of cases of birds that have been taken from the wild.
You just raised another point which is interesting. Although it was always an offence to exchange or sell eggs, we actually found very, very few in my 16 years, very few cases, probably I could count them on one hand, certainly two, where people were caught or admitted to, or we had evidence that people were exchanging or selling eggs. The big dealers all disappeared in 1954 when the 1954 Protection of Birds Act came into being. A big part of the background to all of what you're discussing had to do with informants. There were a huge number of informants out there, most of them who we didn't know who they were, but we knew when they were on the phone, and they were reliable and trustworthy. And a lot of their information, including egg collectors, came from informants.
Right.
I suspect some of those informants were competitors. You know, that somebody was, they were afraid somebody was going to go and rob the nest that they already knew. So,
right.
And that was all part of the background.
That's interesting.
But the bottom line was that because of that, we were over our heads with information. Well, we were fortunate that we could pick and choose which case we went to investigate.
And were you involved in any cases that you can recall, you know, specifically about birds of prey or peregrine falcons?
Yes, I can. But in particular, the 1981 Act introduced the situation that you had to prove to me that you got this bird legally. And that came into being actually in 1982. But for the late 1980s, sorry, the early 1980s, the late 1950s, we were overburdened with numbers of birds of prey being taken from the nest because everybody knew, all the falconers and would-be falconers knew that the legislation was going to change. So they went out and they tried to take their birds before the new legislation came into being. In the late 1970s, I was in touch with Aldermaston Atomic Research, set up down in Berkshire, I think it was. And through them and the Metropolitan Police, we set up a scheme whereby the RSPB wardens were marking eggs and nestlings, peregrine nestlings in particular, with these forensic marks on their legs, which we could then show up in ultraviolet light. That resulted in a lot of convictions that I was personally involved in. I searched a lot of houses in the 1980s. Looking for eggs and looking for peregrine falcons, eggs in incubators.
Right.
An awful lot.
So you're actually going to nests and marking chicks
so
that if they were then sold illegally, you could see the marks later?
Well, if you're going to take a bird, the easy way to do, you know, you can try trapping it, but the easy way to do it is take it as a nestling. Take them out the nest or even take eggs and hatch them at home. And that was going on. So most of the time, we were getting information that somebody or other had peregrines in the garden shed or often up in the bedroom. And we would go in with a search warrant and police officer, and there would be two, three, four peregrine chicks. And the minute they saw you, they started screaming for food. And with eggs, the wardens had a system whereby each warden put a code on. So when we recovered a clutch of peregrine eggs that had been marked by RSPB, I could tell from the markings on them which warden they came from, and he would know, he would then tell me which nest they were from. So it was much more organised and forward-thinking than most people know, because we couldn't talk about it. So if you started talking about it, people would be checking the eggs before they took them.
Yeah, fascinating. And so then were you able to successfully put eggs or put chicks back into nests?
Occasionally we put eggs back, but mostly we put chicks back, yeah. I mean, there were a couple of famous incidents. There were two Scottish lads came down from Scotland with a peregrine chick. We arranged to meet outside Lord's Cricket Ground. What I didn't realise was it was one of the Queen's anniversaries cricket match. When we arrived there, everybody was carrying a wicker basket, but we eventually got hold of these two guys from Scotland with a peregrine, seized the peregrine. They were locked up temporarily. And next morning, the RAF flew it back to Inverness, where Roy Dennis, up in Scotland, put it back into the nest.
Ah, fantastic, yeah. Roy's the man for that job, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Amazing. So I understand that you're writing a book at the moment as well about your experiences.
Yeah, it's currently at about 300 pages, and it revolves around my life and birds, and it starts with London bomb sites at the end of the Second World War. But it also embraces 12 years in the London Fire Brigade, first of all, and then 16 years with RSPB.
Fantastic. Well, we'll look out for that. Do you know when that's going to be published?
No, I don't know. I've still got to find a publisher, though I suspect that won't be difficult. I've been working on it for 4 years, so I'd be pleased to see the end of it any time now.
Yeah, well, I know you've published other books in the past, so good luck finding a publisher. I'm sure you'll have no problems. One thing I just wanted to pick your brains on, if before we finish, if that's okay. You know, obviously bird crimes do still exist. You know, there are 70 million less birds in the UK now than there was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Yep. So I'm guessing egg collecting is not as popular as it was. There's just not as many birds around, but also children and young people now don't get into it. But there will still be people out there doing it. I know that there was a conviction not that long ago, certainly in the last 3 or 4 months, wasn't there? But do you have an idea of how it compares now to its heyday in the 70s?
I get the impression it isn't as anywhere near as serious as it was. And the big problem, as I understand it now, in wildlife crime is in relation to game birds and game bird management and shooting.
Yeah.
And shooting and trapping and poisoning. That seems to be where the problem is. In that arena, it's difficult putting a finger on who the culprit is. You know, is it the underkeeper, the headkeeper, the farm manager, the estate owner?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one of the challenges now, is especially with hen harriers and...
Yeah.
You know, other birds of prey and peregrines, red kites, you know, goshawk, whatever. You know, you're talking about big estates and massive areas that.
I think the problem is as well. I think the person, you have to aim at the person at the top. If the people below him or her are doing what they shouldn't be doing, they're in a position to stop it. They are. When it comes to court matters, they're quite influential.
It's
a difficult area.
Definitely, it'll be interesting to see whether the new legislation in Scotland makes a difference.
Yeah, I suspect it's in danger of getting watered down a bit during discussions. But
yeah, I suspect you may be right. Oh, well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Peter. I really appreciate it.
That's a pleasure.
Sky Hunter, as I've mentioned, led me to develop an interest in birds, which has become a lifelong passion. But for some, the programme has had an even greater influence. I'm joined now by Laura Curtis-Moss, an environmental education specialist based in Scotland. Laura, hello.
Hello, nice to see you.
Thanks so much for coming on. I just wondered if we could start off by you telling me what you remember or what your memories of Sky Hunter are.
My main memory, my sort of key memory, is that there was this baddie and you thought he was the good guy, you know, you thought he was part of the, was it the English League for the Protection of the Falcon? But yeah, you thought he was a good guy and he was actually trying to harm these birds. And I think that was my first real experience as a young person of thinking, oh, there are people that want to do harm to nature. There are people who maybe don't have wildlife's best interest at heart.
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked about that with Roger, the producer, and Jane, one of the actors on the show, and just how that character was so creepy and duplicitous. You know, how he plays the children, but he's a bad guy, but he's this kindly old man that just runs an antique shop and lures them in, not with puppies and sweets, but he lures them in with tat and broken cameras. But yeah, he's a horrible baddie. And I think as a child watching that, it's quite scary and unsettling, isn't it?
Yeah, and he is my key memory. It was just all about him and kind of how sinister he was. And I think he was sending a telegram and pretending to be Welsh, but it was actually a secret code, wasn't it? Which, well, for a children's TV show, it was just writing backwards. And to be honest, even at the time, I was like, oh, a telegram, what? That's pretty outdated.
You must have seen, well, you definitely did see it later than some of us, because it was, we've mentioned, it was rerun many, many times. And, you're a lot younger than some of us who saw it in its earlier runs. So I'm guessing you maybe saw it when it was shown on CBBC, or was it something a teacher showed to you?
We watched it in school, so it was something we watched like every week. The little TV was wheeled out and we watched it probably on VHS, and this would have been sort of early to mid 90s, I think.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of it was still really, really relevant, particularly around the sort of need to protect wildlife, and a lot of the legislation that we have now wasn't in place. But yeah, there were some kind of anachronisms with the telegram, and also why were these children just playing freely and dropping in on their friendly neighborhood antiques dealer? Yeah. That was a bit different to my experience.
One of the things when I was first researching this, when I was looking online, I came across there's a Scottish comedian and presenter called Ashley Story, and she would mention Sky Hunter in a series of tweets, and her being influenced by this show was not necessarily to develop a love of nature, but it was the amateur detective element. And she says that she would just rock up in Glasgow to crime scenes with a notepad and pen, you know, asking the police questions and offering to help, which I thought was quite funny, because there is that sort of, you know, Famous Five element to it as well as the nature stuff.
That's amazing. That's killing me. Yeah, Ash's story is so, so funny. And then, but yeah, and lots of peregrine falcons in central Glasgow as well, to be fair. So she's not a million miles off. And I'm sure the police very much appreciated all the help and support.
I'm not sure how many cases she cracked. I tried to get in touch with her, but she was hard to pin down. So obviously, in terms of your current role, would you say that Sky Hunter influenced you as a child in terms of where you've ended up?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think probably from when I was about 8 years old, I've always been, I guess, a bit of an eco warrior, and, you know, done a lot of volunteering. I've done my time with the RSPB. I was education officer and then education manager for the RSPB in Scotland for quite a number of years. And now, as well as working sort of freelance as an environmental educator, working with young people, possibly amateur detectives, who knows, I manage a climate change charity. So yeah, I kind of dedicated my life to combating those fake antique dealers who want to do nature harm, and definitely trying to work with young people today. I kind of hope it is not still being shown in schools, because I think it would be very, very outdated now. So they need a bit different inspiration.
Yeah, I mean, some of the fashions are outdated, and there's a couple of moments where kids are bundled into the back of the RSPB investigator's car, which would probably be frowned upon nowadays, I think.
No, 100% still happens. just normal practice at the RSPB. Children witness an egg stealing straight in the back of the van.
Excellent. Yeah, I was wondering, like, you know, we were showing this in schools, and, you know, I've spoken to a few people now who remember it and did develop a love of nature through this program. And I wonder where kids get that now, because there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of, you know, school programming generally. You know, there doesn't seem to be a chunk of the curriculum dedicated to this. Where do you think kids get this sort of stuff from now?
I mean, I think it's probably very different in English schools as in Scottish schools, because in Scotland, we do have outdoor learning, we do have learning for sustainability as like a key pillar within the curriculum for excellence. So theoretically, every young person up to the age of 18 in Scotland has an entitlement to outdoor learning and to learning for sustainability, which for particularly in primary school is all about engaging with nature. But different schools do it differently. Some do it incredibly well, some find it really hard. You know, we know teachers are under so much pressure, both sides of the border, they've got so much to do that sometimes, even no matter how much they love nature, they can't necessarily fit the timing. And I think probably one of the key places that young people can have access to nature is if they are able to go out and visit places like RSPB reserves with family, if they do go on school trips, and through kind of outdoor learning, so through things like forest schools and just being out in local nature. I don't think there's anything on children's television, though, that's particularly focusing on certainly not sort of British wildlife. You see a lot, and you see a lot in schools about wildlife, you know, looking at tigers in India or songbirds in Indonesia or, oh, I don't know, whatever exotic creatures in different places. And of course, that's really exciting and really important. But I think quite often people do miss what's like on their doorsteps.
Yeah.
You know, peregrine falcon is the fastest bird in the world. And you can step out your front door in the centre of Glasgow, centre of Edinburgh, centre of Newcastle, and there's not a bad chance of seeing one. Yeah.
I know, it's amazing. And if somebody had told me as a 9-year-old boy watching Sky Hunter that, you know, that I would have peregrines in the city centre in the middle of Newcastle, well, on the Tyne, you know, like there are now, it would have blown my tiny little mind. It's mm-hmm. fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there may well be shows out there. I know there is a show about little creatures. I can't remember the title of it on CBBC or CBBS, Teeny Tiny Creatures or something like that. So they do animal-y stuff, and there probably is stuff out there. My kids are a little bit older than that CBeebies now, so there may be stuff out there, but there certainly isn't anything like Sky Hunter. Thank you so much, Laura.
No, thanks for having me. It's been great to have a chat about it and reminisce a little bit.
Thank you. I was keen to round off this deep dive, or dare I say deep stoop, by exploring the current state of affairs regarding bird crimes in the UK and what has changed since the programme was made. This leads me to my final guest, current RSPB Investigations Officer Tom Gross. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kit.
I wondered if we could start by you outlining for listeners what your job entails on a day-to-day basis.
So I work for the investigations team at the RSPB, and obviously we're a big conservation organisation. We're quite a small team. We've got people based in all four of the UK countries, and our sort of main focus is on crimes affecting birds of conservation concern, and particularly birds of prey. I would say that the majority of our work focuses on rapt persecution. A lot of that is linked to game bird shooting, but also a significant portion of my work in particular focuses on the taking of birds of prey, particularly peregrines, for the illegal falconry trade. And that is something that's always gone on and has gone up and down over the years. But we have seen this sort of emerging trend in that trade being driven by a demand in the Middle East for peregrines. And these birds can fetch relatively large sums of money. They're seen as desirable. The genetics of wild northern peregrines, people want those in their stables, I suppose, is the word that you choose to use, you know, in the same way that racehorse genetics are prized. You know, if you've got a bird that is a good racer, these birds are used for racing these days rather than traditional falconry in the Middle East. And that's where the cultures come from. You know, it's been a traditional pastime in a lot of Middle Eastern countries. But these days, you know, where there's a lot more money to be spent, these birds are sort of status symbol, and they're predominantly used for a sport called falcon racing. And that has seen more birds being taken from the wild here and exported overseas than there have been previously.
Right. So one of the questions I was going to ask you was regarding bird crimes generally. Are things better now, almost 50 years on from when Sky Hunter was made? But I think what you've just said is specifically around peregrines, you know, things maybe are even worse.
Well, it's an interesting question, really, because I think if you look at our bird of prey populations, the picture's brighter. You know, I can remember, you know, as a child growing up in the south of England, when I first saw Sky Hunter, you know, to see a bird like a buzzard be a major event. You know, they were seen on sort of holidays to Wales or the West Country. Whereas now, you know, I live in a fairly urban location in a Yorkshire city, and some days I can see two or three pairs of buzzards up around my house. So peregrines, you know, have recovered tremendously since the programme was made. So the population's higher, and they've certainly gone back to a lot more of their old haunts where they were lost in that sort of post-war period with the rise of DDT. However, that sort of larger population, you know, is still absent from some areas where they should be. Those areas, sometimes you could map those on a on a part of the country and think, well, those are upland areas dominated by driven grouse shooting. And that is one of the factors that keeps those populations low, is that persecution associated with that. But in terms of birds being taken for falconry, you know, this rise in population has meant that there is this pool of birds out there for people that are willing to take a risk and steal the eggs or chicks. Bird crime in general, I suppose, since the programme have made, trends emerge and fade. And say, for example, egg collection, which was probably a really big deal when the programme was made and was responsible for the suppression of species like osprey and things like that from re-establishing themselves. There were custodial sentences introduced for that in the 2000s, and the sort of hardcore of serious egg collectors were put under a lot of pressure by the fact that they'd be going to prison if they were caught. And that had a huge effect. So egg collecting now is really, really rare. You know, we think that there might be fewer than 20 serious egg collectors in the country, and how many of those are actively collecting eggs is probably fewer. So, you know, that's a success story. But in terms of peregrines being stolen from the wild, it's a bit more of a complex picture. We saw the introduction of DNA fingerprinting brought in the 90s. And that meant that when you went to a peregrine breeder and they said, oh, yes, these chicks are from my pair of peregrines, you could then compare their DNA to the supposed parent birds. And obviously, if they didn't match, then there'd be, you know, questions to ask. But unfortunately, peregrines were formally, you would have to register them with DEFRA if you kept them, much as you would have to do with, say, a car with a logbook. You'd have to send it off to the DVLA. You'd have to do the same with your peregrines, so they'd know where peregrines were, who had them in captivity. They were sort of deregistered in the sort of mid-2000s. So now if you want to sell them, they need a certificate that you just keep or pass on to the new owner, but you don't have to send anything off. So there isn't this sort of check and balance on them. So it's made it a lot easier for people to launder wild taken peregrines as captive bred birds. And once you've done that, you know, once you've got these chicks and you've fitted a ring on their legs and said, these are the offspring of my captive pair, then you can export them ostensibly legally. And there's no real way, you know, unless you get really lucky or you've got really good evidence and you go and DNA test the birds, to prevent that from happening. So that's a bit of a loophole. And I think, you know, without that being closed, it means that there's this pathway for these birds that are being taken in the wild to be exported abroad where they're demanded.
I've read about a couple of sort of fairly high profile cases, even in the last 12 months, involving peregrine crimes.
Yeah. So talk about probably the one that I know best, which is a case that I was involved in Derbyshire. So we're really lucky in Derbyshire. You know, it's a county with a lot of limestone that's been quarried. So it's made these sort of, you know, brilliant peregrine nesting habitats. They love these limestone quarries. We've also got, you know, the Depete district, which is also, you know, very sort of traditional peregrine area. And peregrine sort of re-established themselves in the county in the 80s, in the early 80s. And since then, in areas where there isn't grouse shooting, they have done really well. That has led, I suppose, to Derbyshire being one of the counties that's got the highest rate of illegal peregrine theft. And one of the other things that we're lucky with in Derbyshire is we've got this fantastic network of raptor workers who are volunteers who go and monitor breeding birds of prey. So we've got a really good idea about where these birds are nesting and their sort of success or failure year on year. You know, if you were to look at a list of peregrine sites going back, say, over the last 10 years, you could see sites that were problematic, that were failing year on year for no discernible reason. And you wouldn't know unless you went and put a camera on that particular pair of peregrines why they were failing. You know, it could be that one of the birds was older and infertile. It could be that, you know, the scrape was being washed out in heavy rain. You know, they're not, I don't want to talk badly about peregrines in a podcast that's focused on them, but sometimes they're not the brightest birds. And I've definitely seen ones, you know, nest on a scrape that probably not the most suitable. And, you know, you get a big downpour and everything gets washed out. But there are definitely sites where there were a few alarm bells ringing. You know, these sites weren't producing chicks. And sometimes on a visit, you'd think, well, was that stone below the nest? Was that there before? Has that fallen off the cliff? Does it look like someone's climbed it? And, you know, a lot of these are pretty precipitous quarries. You know, you'd have to go in with a rope. So you've got this network of raptor workers. They're telling you the success or failure of these sites. And I try and sort of look and see where I think my kind of top couple of priorities every breeding season are going to be. Where do I think, if I put a camera in, am I going to stand the best chance of catching someone taking chicks? Because when I joined the team, you know, I knew that it was an issue. I knew it was happening. And I knew that people had been caught before, but the problem wasn't going away. So last year, yeah, like I said, a quarry in limestone in Derbyshire, and I'd learned that it failed for the last couple of years to produce chicks. So fortunately, we had a really good relationship with the quarry operator, and we got their permission to go put some cameras in. So everything was going fine. You know, I would go and I'd check on the birds, and either the male or the female would be sat on the scrape incubating. And then one time I went back and they were both sat off the scrape, and I thought, well, that's a bit interesting, you know. So I took the footage home and I looked back at it on the laptop, and flicking back through the footage, I could see sort of birds sat on the nest, birds sat on the nest, birds sat on the nest. And there was a day when there wasn't, you know, and I thought, oh, okay. We start to go through it with a bit more of a fine tooth comb. And on one day, suddenly off camera, you can hear a peregrine alarming. You know, they're really noisy birds. They're not shy of letting you know when they're unhappy. And, you know, as the male is alarming off camera, suddenly the female becomes a bit agitated. You can see her on the footage looking around. She's looking upwards and she stands up on the scrape, and then you can see a rope drop down. She flies off the nest. A guy comes down on the rope. He's got what looks like sort of insulated bag around his waist, you know, like a little cool bag. And, you know, this is over in a matter of minutes. You know, he's a skilled climber. He comes down on a harness. He takes three objects out the scrape, puts them into the bag, and then goes back up the rope. You know, and like I said, this is quick. It happens really fast. Fortunate to have a good relationship with the rural crime team in Derbyshire. I was straight on the phone to them. They were straight out to the site the same evening. We had a look to see what evidence we could find above the scrape, whether there could be any forensics done. And then they later got a specialist climbing team to go and recover some DNA, some feathers from the nest. You know, if we were to be successful in tracing this guy, you know, if there were chicks, we could DNA test them against those. The police did a great job. They identified the guy in the footage. A warrant was done. Unfortunately, we weren't able to recover any eggs or chicks. You know, and the suspicion is that those eggs were hatched in an incubator and those chicks were laundered as captive bred. But the guy ended up in court and he was prosecuted both for taking the eggs and for disturbing the adults, which obviously a Schedule 1 bird, they're protected from disturbance when they're breeding. And he went to prison, which was, I suppose, a success. You know, it's great to have that as a deterrent, but obviously we didn't get these birds back. And what was also slightly, for me, always the main thing in these cases is you want to get up the chain. You know, this guy was at the bottom of the ladder. He was probably being paid a small amount to take these birds, and then they went off to somebody else. And the aim is always that we think, well, you know, who's driving this trade? Who's making the money out of it? That's always the hope in these cases. You can get up the ladder. You know, it didn't happen on this occasion, but it's not going to stop us or the raptor workers or the police, you know, focusing on this kind of thing. You know, this season we're out there doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's obviously got to be bittersweet for you when you get a conviction and somebody goes to prison. You know, that's a real plus point, because that doesn't often happen, does it, with bird crimes, particularly raptor persecution. We see it time and time again with hen harriers on moors managed for driven grouse shooting.
Yeah, I think with any wildlife crime, you know, it's a really emotive issue. And I think the public's always quite shocked and disappointed. You know, the perception is that sentences being handed down by courts are unduly lenient. suppose. And, you know, this is the first time that I've been involved in a case that someone's gone to prison. And I'm not going to lie, there are mixed feelings there, because quite often the people that end up in court, they're not the people that are really benefiting from carrying out those crimes. You know, I said, you know, explain the situation with these peregrines, but it's the same with, you know, with gamekeepers on moors. You know, gamekeepers aren't killing birds because they love doing it. You know, they're doing it because they've got pressure on them to do so. And it's not them that are really benefiting. So, yeah, I would always like to see us getting up the ladder. You know, that's the main thing. And in terms of sentences from courts, yeah, it was a big deal to see this guy go to prison. But courts are quite often hamstrung by the fact that there aren't sentencing guidelines available for magistrates with Wildlife and Countryside Act offences. They are crimes that they do not deal with very often. And yeah, one of the main things really is kind of getting this stuff out in the public domain. The laws are never going to change. Loopholes in the laws aren't going to get changed. Sentencing guidelines aren't going to get introduced unless there's big public pressure. You know, people getting angry, and the more people that know about it, the better. That's almost the biggest win in these cases. So we will always try and get this sort of thing out into the public domain. I think it's really, really important. That is both a deterrent, hopefully, to people that are carrying out these crimes, but also, you know, it lets people know that it's going on in the countryside.
Yeah.
Get picked up by national news and things like that, when, you know, which we did in this case. You know, you've got people seeing it on their news programs and thinking, wow, peregrines are amazing birds. You know, everyone's heard of peregrine falcons, even if they're not into wildlife. They're absolutely iconic. So the fact that we've got this illegal trade going on in this country, I think, would be gobsmacking to most people. So, yeah, it's important to get it out there.
Absolutely. And I think that brings us back around to Sky Hunter, which put bird crimes into classrooms. How old were you when you first saw Sky Hunter, and what was it about the programme that made such an impact on you?
So I went to a little rural primary school, and I probably saw it when I was about 6 or 7. And, you know, I was, you know, nature obsessed as a kid. And I was really lucky, you know, where I grew up. You know, it's just sort of typical farmland area. And it was just sort of one of those childhoods where I spent my time messing about in fields and streams and whatever. I was really lucky. So I was always, you know, if you had to draw something or write something in school, it would always be about animals or wildlife. And that's sort of all I've ever known and wanted to do with my life. But for it to be a program that came on at school, you know, it was so exciting. You know, and obviously there's all sorts of great aspects to that program, you know, absolute classic bits of knitwear, messing about on the canal, you know, just, yeah, brilliant. When I saw it, would have been probably about 1990-91 maybe, so it might be the second time around.
Yeah,
so even then it kind of had this sort of vintage feel.
Yeah,
but I think the other thing about it that really strikes is young kids, they've got this real moral sense about them, you know, about right and wrong.
Yeah.
Children's sense of right and wrong, or someone being bad or someone hurting something or doing the wrong thing, is, I think, really, you really see it in children that age. And that program, I think, really spoke to that. Those kids saw something bad happening and they were going to sort it out, you know. And that's great. Like, that's such a kid of that age thing to do. That sort of moral sense, I don't want to get on my high horse, but you wouldn't do the job that I do or that anyone on my team does, or even, to be honest, work in conservation full stop. Certainly no one does it for the money, and sometimes you can really feel like you're swimming against the tide. But that feeling of injustice, particularly with I think birds or with animals that, you know, are up against it and need help, that feeling of right and wrong is kind of what drives you.
Yeah.
In the job that I do. So it really spoke to me at the time. You know, obviously it was exciting and there were baddies, and, you know, it probably didn't actually feature probably peregrines all that much.
No, it didn't.
It was sort of mainly about that kind of mystery and trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's an incredibly powerful thing for small children. And it really did stay with me. You know, I grew up, like I said, in the south of England. I moved up to Yorkshire probably about 20 years ago. And I started to work in the uplands doing a sort of moorland restoration work and bird surveys up in the hills. And it sort of quickly became apparent that up on the moors, where this sort of beautiful wild landscape, there was something not quite right. And I think as a bird surveyor, you saw it. There was a lack or a scarcity of some species that really should be there that weren't. And that kind of re-sparked this interest that I had in bird crime, in birds of prey. And I started to find out more about why I wasn't seeing birds like hen harriers, you know, in the Peak District. And that was due to kind of years of systemic persecution at a national scale. And, you know, that applies to peregrines as well. And that sort of led me back to the RSPB's investigations team, really. And I started to work for them on a hen harrier project that was funded by the EU. And I've worked for them for the past 6 years. So, yeah, like I said before, I was always going to work with nature. I don't think there was any two ways about it. But that program at school was incredibly formative. Yeah.
Fantastic. So, well, I guess we'll never know whether the program led you to where you are now or whether the seed was sown because of seeing those three plucky kids on a barge.
I think childhood experiences like that probably mean more than you realise. So, yeah, I think I can remember when I wrote my first application to come and work with this team, thinking about Skyhunter. So, yeah, I don't think it ever went away, really.
Brilliant. Oh, that's fantastic. Tom, thanks so much for coming on today and telling me about your work and sharing your stories and memories of Skyhunter. That's been brilliant. Thanks.
No problem. Thanks a lot for having me on.
So there we have it. A programme created almost 50 years ago by Roger Tong and Leonard Kingston as they walked along London's canals is likely to have been more formative and influential than they ever imagined or intended, and its themes are still very much relevant today. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast episode on Skyhunter, which I realise has been a rather nostalgic labour of love for me. If you haven't seen it and are interested, all episodes have been edited into one YouTube video that you can find by searching for Skyhunter. And if you have seen it, especially if you saw it as a kid, I'd love to hear from you. Drop me a line via the Golden Grenades website. To bring us to a close, I'm going to leave you with a clip from the show. Jackie's passionate speech to Mr. Trim that I mentioned earlier when they finally foil his nefarious plan. Until next time, bye for now.
You should be ashamed of yourself, Mr. Trim.
Should I? Why? Because I won't be a sneak, a telltale?
No, because you only pretend to love falcons.
I do love falcons.
But you've killed them and stolen their eggs. Do you call that love?
I am a collector. Collecting eggs helps one to study.
Every egg you collect means one more dead falcon. Why do you need so many eggs? Why? You had hundreds.
Because the more one has, the more valuable.
Yes, that's it. Money. That's why you're helping those crooks to sell a stolen wild one. You don't really want to protect wild birds. You only like them when they're dead and stuffed and standing about in your rotten collection. You're just selfish and greedy. All you want is the money.
Yes, that's telling him, Jackie. Mr. Roberts said so to us, didn't he, Butch? And you said so yourself, that things go on as they are.
Yeah, there'll be no more falcons. People like you and Cat Mary, with your killing and stealing and selling, you're putting an end to them all.
You don't really care if one day there aren't any falcons left.